Welcome to Football with Grant Wall. Thanks so much for joining me. Our interview guest today is Kelsey Trainer, a lawyer and women's sports advocate. On the U.S. Women's National Team's $24 million settlement with U.S. Soccer. Before we get going, you can sign up for a free or paid subscription to my newsletter at grantwall.com. It has all my writing, including on-site coverage of every U.S. Men's National Team World Cup qualifier. That's grantwall.com. The best way to support my work is by taking out a paid subscription now. In segment one, Chris Whittingham and I will break down the soccer news. We'll have my interview with Kelsey Trainer in segment two. Let's bring in Witty. How are you, my friend?
I, for a moment, was possessed to almost join you in your hey there and welcome to Football with Grant Wall, but then I decided that I didn't want to interrupt you. But like one of these times, you're going to do the countdown into the show, and I will join you in shouting, hey there! Welcome to Football. Like I, for a moment, was going to do it, but I decided against it.
Please do it. At some point, I'll probably
when you're least expecting it,
I'll probably be surprised and thrown off my game. But like, yeah, please do it. There's so much happening in the soccer world, Chris. I mean, like, this is that weekend where MLS starts again, and the European calendar's going and doing its thing, and it just feels like stuff is happening everywhere. So there's a lot to talk about. I do want to start a little bit with real life, which is the Russia situation, which is ongoing and heavy and, you know, just really depressing and sad that Russia decided to invade Ukraine. We're in the middle of it. It's terrible. And so it kind of like makes everything in the soccer world pale in comparison. But obviously there's a component in the soccer world with a lot of this stuff. One of them being the Russian national team, which is involved in World Cup qualifying still in the playoffs that are supposed to take place in March. They're supposed to host Poland, and then Sweden and the Czechs are also in that group, all of whom are fighting for one spot in the Qatar World Cup. And so much going on back and forth. We're recording this at, I'm in Barcelona, so it's like 1 a.m. on Monday, but like, I guess it's 7 p.m. on the East Coast. And so as of right now, FIFA, taking as much time as it wants to with this whole thing, proposed the idea of playing this on neutral ground. It sounds like, well, the other teams, Poland, the Czechs, the Swedes, are saying like, no, we're just not going to play Russia at all in this. And we'll see where this process leads us in the end. But at this point, I just feel like, and I tweeted this a second ago, I feel like every national soccer federation in the world, including U.S. soccer, by the way, needs to say, we will not play Russia anytime, anywhere, and that's non-negotiable. And Russia needs to be viewed as a pariah state for doing what they've done here. And I don't think this is all very complicated. Am I missing anything?
Well, I do think that the United Nations not being able to come to this very same conclusion hurts the case of FIFA, because at the very least you could use the United Nations example as precedent. But no, I mean, otherwise, I mean, it's frankly for countries that aren't in Europe, really not that complicated. For like for the U.S., who is kind of viewed as in some ways the leader of the opposition, obviously NATO is, but certainly from my perspective, it seems as though the U.S. has played a big role in trying to talk Vladimir Putin off of doing this. Obviously, those deterrents did not work, and we'll see what the sanction reaction is, and frankly, what the global reaction has been. And frankly, I found it incredibly brave of Russian people, Russian figures, who it must be very scary to speak against Vladimir Putin, you know, given what's happened to some of his opponents, still kind of bravely saying, like the tennis player that won the tournament in Dubai, who wrote on a camera, you know, let's turn towards peace. You have Ukrainian figures in the game who had incredibly emotional scenes. You look at Alexander Zinchenko of Manchester City. You look at Robin Yaremchuk of Benfica, who had that moment where he comes on and the entire stadium starts chanting for him and he starts welling up in tears on the field. So these incredibly big and important public spectacles in support of Ukraine against Putin, and maybe this kind of brings that public tide towards the Russian people who disagree with this war, towards Ukraine against Putin, and frankly makes it easy for those international sporting authorities to make the easy decision of banning Russia from events. And frankly, I don't think the Olympic model of have them play under ROC, I guess in FIFA's case it would be RFU, which is the Russian Football Union, which I guess would be a funny thing to put it on the graphic on the top left corner, RFU. But I don't think that's enough, and I admire the public statement. I like my FIFA kind of skepticism makes me think that they're going to throw those three countries out of the World Cup and keep Russia in it because they're the only one who agreed to play. Like, that's how little I think of FIFA, that I think that they might pull something like that. But you've got to kick Russia out of this competition. You just do.
Yeah. I mean, that's where I am. I have admiration, by the way, for Fyodor Smolov of the Russian national team, who came out against this action by Russia. Any Russian who protest what's happening by Russia right now, I admire. So we're seeing protests from some Russians in St. Petersburg and Moscow and other cities who are being treated horribly by police there. So tremendous admiration for those people. So tremendous admiration for Fyodor Smolov. I still don't by the idea, and Alexei Lalas put this out, of like, oh, you shouldn't punish the players by banning Russia from the World Cup. Are you kidding me? Like, there's precedent for this, right? So South Africa, apartheid era South Africa, was not welcome in the international sports community for decades, for good reason, including by FIFA. And so there may have been some players on those apartheid era South Africa teams who weren't bad people, who weren't racists, but that doesn't mean that you should have let South Africa play in the international sphere during the apartheid era. Same thing applies here. And I realize that there are some apples and oranges comparisons. There are some apples to apples comparisons. I'm really tired on social media right now of whataboutism. I'm tired of making the very sort of like basic, obvious statement that Russia should not be a part of this World Cup. They should be banned from this World Cup. And if someone wants to say that the U.S. should have been banned from World Cup 2006, because of George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq, I would say this, that I did not agree with that. I agree. I actually thought the Afghanistan invasion was, that was legit. That the invasion of Iraq was not. That, for me, war crimes were committed in places like Abu Ghraib. I realize we're getting far afield from soccer here. Sorry. But I would also say that if you're going to say that is an apples to apples comparison for the Iraq invasion to what Russia is doing now in Ukraine, that is not accurate. It's just not accurate.
I agree. And I don't think that you need to have a 100% consistent line of who gets thrown out of a World Cup. You can just take it when you see it. Like, you don't have to be 100% consistent here. And you can just say, Russia invading a sovereign nation, grounds for removal, period, the end. And that's what this is. And also, in the grand scheme of things, being thrown out of a World Cup, although I will say, sports has had a role to play in Russia's standing in the world, right? And Russia seeming like a nation that wouldn't do this, hosting a World Cup, hosting an Olympics. They have done a ton, and there's a reason why Vladimir Putin put so much into sports, and reportedly doesn't really care about the actual results that much. He just understands what it means to a nation to seem like your average normal nation with, you know, a normal pattern of behavior that has a big standing in the world. That sports has had a role to play in that. However, being thrown out of the World Cup, is really not that important in the grand scheme of what the fallout from this is going to be. And so let's just say they're out. If everything is fine in 4 years, they can go again. It's really not the most important thing in the world. But for the moment, it should be a fairly open and shut case of they should not be in the World Cup.
No, I'm with you on that. And look, there's a history for me with like going to the World Cup in Russia in 2018. My side employer then was Fox Sports, which very clearly made a decision not to say a single critical word about Russia during that World Cup. And they didn't. In fact, they actually promoted it as this tourist destination you should go to. And there was plenty of stuff you could have said, right? About invading Crimea in 2014, about invading Georgia in 2008. And instead, Fox didn't do that. They talked about going to Stalin's dacha as this like cool place to go to. It's interesting, though, for me, from a professional perspective, I knew that Fox was going to do that, and I was working for them. Mm-hmm. And so right before the World Cup in 2018, in my Sports Illustrated capacity at the time, I got Garry Kasparov, the former world chess champion from Russia, Putin opponent, one of the most like prominent Putin opponents out there, to come on my podcast. And I asked him the question, how should we feel about being excited about the World Cup in Russia? And I felt good about at least asking him the question because he put everything in perspective about how Putin was using that World Cup, how the whole political realm was using that World Cup. And at least I was able to sort of get that into the discussion because I'll be honest, I mean, this Qatar World Cup is coming up, and Qatar is different from Russia, but there's a lot of questions about this Qatar World Cup. And I speak to you right now coming from spending the last week in Qatar and doing reporting, actual journalism, which will come out soon enough. I don't want to give away too much, but like, asking the question of how should we feel about these World Cups in authoritarian states? Should we feel okay about watching the games? Should we resolve not to watch them? And if anyone wants to make that decision, like, I'm okay with that. Basically, the decision I've made is I'm going to go to the World Cup in Qatar in November and cover the soccer. But I could not do that in my conscience without having spent a week there this past week doing actual journalism. Didn't put it out on my social media that I was there. Didn't want to get detained. Thankfully didn't, but got good reporting. And the world's so freaking complicated, Chris. This is tough.
Yeah. It is very complicated. It's complicated to, like you said, know how to feel when you enter these things. And also, when the tournament or the thing is happening, not allow those issues to just fall on the back burner because you're covering the soccer, right? Try to, while you're there, mention some of how Qatar got this World Cup, what its goals are, and kind of put in front of the audience, don't allow this to happen. Don't allow... You know, and maybe we didn't do a good enough job of this in Russia, of basically saying don't allow for this to kind of seem normal, and don't allow for Qatar and some of their behaviors and their anti-women and anti-gay policies just seem normal, because they're not. And so just keep making sure that the goals of Saudi Arabia with Newcastle United and the WWE and what they do in sports, and the UAE with the City Football Group, and even Roman Abramovich with Chelsea, and all these different, you know, the Qataris with Paris Saint-Germain, all these groups and what they've done to make their place in the world of sport allow them to carry their policies into those arenas seem normal, right? Make sure that when you're watching all these things, you know, oh, this isn't great, and FIFA made a dumb decision here, and you know, and the Premier League made a dumb decision, several dumb decisions here with allowing some of these people into their league, and make sure that you hold your stakeholders accountable for the decisions that they've made for to allow these things to happen.
No, and you said that really well. I mean, like, I also look at the UN Security Council resolution this last couple of days where the United Arab Emirates, which owns City Football Group, including New York City FC, abstained in a potential sanction against Russia. And obviously, everyone knew that Russia, as a permanent member of the UN Security Council, was going to veto that, right? So they weren't going to get the resolution. They wanted to get everyone on the record. UAE went on the record. They abstained. Remember that. New York City, FC, Man City. So it's hard to transition into soccer talk at that point.
Especially when the first thing that we kind of decided we're going to talk about involves the owner of a football club who is linked with Russian oligarchy, linked with Putin, and gave up, we don't even know what that means, but handed over the running of the football club to the trustees of the Chelsea Foundation the day before this game that we talked about today, which, by the way, if not for that backdrop, was a cracking game of football.
Yeah. Best 0-0 game I've seen in my life. I'm serious.
Yes.
Like, League Cup final, Liverpool-Chelsea, 0-0, goes to penalties. Amazing penalties.
Incredible.
Taken. Right? 21 for 21. The 22nd penalty by goalkeeper Kepa Arrizabalaga goes into the stratosphere. Liverpool wins. And so many chances in this game.
Oh.
So many opportunities. So many disallowed goals. Some rightly, some maybe not rightly. VAR. Everything going on. And one of the more memorable games we've seen, and I don't pay much attention to the League Cup typically, but this was a really memorable game. And I thought Liverpool ended up deserving to win it. And look, I feel bad for Kepa. Strategic choice by Thomas Tuchel to take out Edouard Mendy toward the end of the game, bring in Kepa for penalties. Kepa didn't stop any penalties, by the way.
Yep.
And I don't think you can blame him for, like, his penalty. Nobody thinks that the goalkeepers are going to end up taking penalties, right?
No, and fair play to Kevin Kelleher, who took his really well, the Liverpool second-choice keeper who ended up scoring what would be the winning penalty. But, I mean, yeah, there's so much to break down from this game. First off, I thought Peter Drury on commentary, first off, as usual, had a tremendous game. And I think... at one point, he used the expression the cavorting curtailed or something like that, which was a common occurrence for Thomas Tuchel because he would go nuts after somebody scored a goal. And then I believe he said on the tombstone of this game was, "But the flag is up," and that like that happens so many times in this game where Chelsea had chances to score goals, they would score the goal, and then the offside flag would go up against them three or four times in the game, and Christian Pulisic probably should have scored in the first half. Mason Mount probably should have scored in the first half, then hit the post on a second occasion. I mean, Chelsea had so many chances, but so did Liverpool. You know, look at Sadio Mane's, you know, double save from his Senegalese teammate, Edouard Mendy. Mane had an incredible chance. Luis Diaz put in a tremendous performance in this game. You know, Joel Matip scored, but also the flag eventually came up. So it's fascinating how many chances both teams had in this game to score. And yet, 120 minutes went by and it finished 0-0. And by the way, like just like as a we're Americans talking about soccer, that when you say to people, like when people sarcastically talk about the game, "Oh, but the game can end 0-0, you should respond, "Yeah, but sometimes that's great." And I know that sounds completely idiotic. I know that we wished every game would finish 4-3, but sometimes 0-0 can be really entertaining. And you should tell people that when people talk shit about soccer, because it's frankly not true. That was an enthralling game, as good of a game as you'll see, and there were no goals in it.
On a knife edge the entire way, and Look, I felt like both teams actually had goals that should have been allowed that VAR disallowed. So like Lukaku's goal, for example, like the telemetry guys came into play here and disallowed it. And he, you know, he was pointing to his teammate where to pass the ball. And because he stuck out his arm, he was offside.
Yeah.
And by a fraction of an inch. And in MLS, because MLS is so cheap, they don't want to install the telemetry. They've actually hit upon, accidentally, the right way to approach this, which is to approach offside, VAR-wise, as clear and obvious. Only if it's clear and obvious should you call it on VAR. Because we're cheap. We're MLS.
I will say, though, on the field, it was given as offside. So, like,
I that's the one time they shouldn't do it.
But like, I saw somebody tweet about this. I'm like, but the correct decision was given, right? We've decided where the offside is drawn from.
I know what side you're on here, and I saw your tweet, and I was like, okay, like down to the fraction of an inch. But like, I like the MLS way of approaching it. I don't think they should have called it offside. I think that goal should have counted, but I think it also should have been canceled out because I don't think the Liverpool goal scored by Matip should have been disallowed because that Van Dijk, whatever it was, that pick or whatever,
oh yeah,
was not a thing for me.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's like it's an involvement in the play from an offside position. Like I've never kind of understood the rules on that one, but. My feeling about the offside thing was I don't think in MLS that goal would be given because that camera.
No.
I mean, from that camera angle, like you can't definitively say that's all. Like what we were looking at, it looked obvious, but that camera angle is not in line with the decision, and so I'm not sure that if the assistant on the field says that's offside, and then you look at that, you can't say definitively I think that's onside. I just don't think
the MLS referee would not have raised his flag.
Hmm. I don't know. Maybe. But either way, it was given as offside on the field. They went to this technology that they've come up with to determine offside. We all know that offside starts from the badge on the shirt sleeve. We draw the line from the shirt sleeve, and he was offside. So I just don't know what you want us to do other than get decisions correct, which this was the correct decision. Now, spirit of the rule. I agree with you. Lukaku pointing into space. That should count. That's not what offside was about. But the way that we've determined the rules, that was the correct decision. What are we upset about?
Chris's new nickname is Chris. He's an inch offside Whittingham.
Look, I want more goals too, but what do we want other than the decisions to be correct? It was a correct decision. It doesn't feel good, but it was a correct decision.
Are you like a AYSO referee in your spare time? Like,
I have to be honest. I've thought about it. If I had any free time, I think I might dedicate myself towards becoming a referee.
You know what? We've got few enough referees as it is, so I hope you do that. I hope you tell the story. Come on the podcast. We'll talk about it. I would hate to be a referee. It would be so bad. Okay, so because the League Cup final took so long, I am in Barcelona. I was hoping to go to the game tonight here in Barcelona. I didn't make it because I was writing about it. But Barcelona winning big against Athletic Club is really rallying now. And I'm not saying they're going to win La Liga or anything, but like under Xavi, they're Barcelona again over the last few weeks. And that has to do with some of their player acquisitions from Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang to Dani Alves to Ferran Torres. But like even Sergiño Dest has been rehabilitated lately under Xavi. And I'm wondering, I guess my question for you would be, is Xavi the real thing? Is this a thing that is really happening now with Barcelona becoming Barcelona again?
I think it's still to be determined because Barcelona being Barcelona again is a very lofty standard. It's hitting for 90 points in La Liga on a consistent basis. And I still think that this Barcelona team is some distance away. Just when you look at the talent that they have, I think they need to produce some players, sell them on, and get some big fees to then bring in the level of talent that they need in order to hit the heights in La Liga. So I still think that you look at this squad, and I would say, you know, if Pedri really kicks on, you've got a player that's that level. If Gavi kicks on, you've got a player. If Ferran Torres, maybe you got three or four guys that are of that level. But Aubameyang's on the downslope. Adama Traore is not really that level, I don't think. You know, Busquets and Piqué are on the downslope. Dest, I think, has some ways to go before he's at that level. So this is a really good step. And even, like, for example, like some of the Madrid fans are having a pop at them because they enjoyed their win in the Europa League over Napoli, which I think is really impressive given that they're a Serie A title contender. But that's kind of where they are right now. They're not going to be a top-level Champions League club. They're going to, you know, like every once in a while fall into the Europa League. And if they're going to not be that club anymore, they've got to take some steps forward. So this is an immensely positive sign. I would say probably the thing that's most encouraging for them right now is how they're scoring goals, because they hit for four against Athletic. They hit for four against Napoli. They hit for four against Valencia. They hit for four against Atletico Madrid. If you look at their results earlier this season, they were not scoring goals like that, even when they won games. So that's how it starts to look like old Barcelona. But I still think that they have some ways to go, and maybe Xavi is the person that can lead them there, but he also needs to bring through a lot more talent, both young and transfers, to really get them to that level.
I'm with you on almost all of that. What I would say is that I'm pretty impressed with what's happened in the last few weeks with Barcelona. And I want to pay a special mention to Luke de Jong. Luke de Jong is, for me, the definition of, at least over the last few months, of like an acquisition who is not a Barcelona player, in quotes. Luke de Jong is actually doing really well. He's sort of a plan B, that he'll never be in the Barcelona DNA, right? He's Luke de Jong. But as a plan B, he can score goals. And he's scored quite a few goals now. And I'm impressed with what Ousmane Dembele did today to sort of fight off all the whistles from his own fans. And maybe I'm going to, like, no longer say Luke de Jong is not a Barcelona player.
And I think you've seen a lot of that from the Barcelona supporters of, oh my God, look how far we fell and we had to sign Luke de Jong. And some of those guys are coming through for them now. And so I think that's I think that's really cool from a personality standpoint, that de Jong is not, he's not only like score goals, he scored some big ones too, like late in the day to win matches goals for Barcelona. So I think eventually you probably stop being overawed by playing for Barcelona and you just start playing, right? Like, and I think that's probably something that a lot of these guys had to get over, because you arrive at this club that's still Mescun club, 100,000 seats at the Camp Nou. You walk in, you go, holy hell, I'm playing for Barcelona. But I think now you're starting to see them settle in a little bit. At the very least, as you mentioned, play your role, right? Aubameyang is probably the player that deserves to lead the line for Barcelona, but De Jong can absolutely play a role. And playing well for this club can certainly be a springboard towards him having a more solid career going forward. So, yeah, good for him and good for a lot of the guys that are contributing right now, when you probably, in, you know, look back 8 years ago, would never have gotten into a Barcelona team in a million years.
So, let's talk MLS opening weekend. 14 games, as we're going to get most weekends, because there's 28 teams in the league now. That's a lot of games. We're not going to talk about all of them.
What do you mean? But I'm ready. I've blurbs on all 14. What are you talking about?
Oh my God. But I would say probably one of the biggest standouts of the weekend, Carlos Vela hat trick for LAFC as they take care of Colorado. And I would say LAFC and Carlos Vela, there's a big question about, is Carlos Vela going to be a relevant player in MLS this season? It's a contract year for him. He's obviously hit the heights. He's been MVP in the league. But to have a hat trick in 50 minutes in the first game of this season is a big statement.
Against the team that finished top of the West last year. And yeah, they're coming off CONCACAF Champions League and some heartbreak in losing in the week to Comunicaciones, but still, that's a strong squad that Colorado fielded against LAFC. And really now the question is Carlos Vela going to be fit and motivated for 34 games? Because if he is, that's terrifying. And that's always been the case, even when they've struggled the last two seasons in not making the playoffs. Like, that's a terrifying proposition if you can get Carlos Vela going and ready to play. And frankly, now, the thing that's kind of disappointing to me is that Bob Bradley didn't stick around for this version of the team. And maybe they wouldn't have built the team in this way. Maybe, you know, he wanted that team in a certain way. But I'm actually disappointed in myself that last week when we did our MLS preview, I didn't go further in on LAFC. Because then I looked at their squad and it's like, wow, it's a good team. And if they build a structure around Carlos Vela that can allow him to thrive, this is impressive. You look at, you know, their midfield of Ilya, Cifuentes, and Acosta. Two of those guys have been really proven in MLS, and Ilya and Acosta. Cifuentes is coming along. You know, they bring in Franco Escobar, who played a right back, Maxime Crepeau, veteran goal, and they've got more depth as well to come off the bench. I mean, they brought Chicho Arango off the bench, who was, you know, the newcomer of the year last year. So they've got a lot that can surround Carlos Vela with talent, probably more than they've had in the last couple seasons after that kind of first team really came through and looked like they were going to be the best team in the league for years to come. But they put a structure around him, and they look really impressive against Colorado, and that's a real statement intent going forward of, all right, LAFC's ready to be a contender. And they were actually still on DraftKings the favorites to win MLS Cup, even after everything that they've gone through. And I wonder how much Vela is a part of that, because I think, you know, probably those rating systems must recognize that he is head and shoulders at his best, the best player in the league.
I will say this about MLS. It's got its issues, right? But at the beginning of the season, right now, there are a lot of teams that I would say are capable of winning the MLS Cup, right?
Yeah.
A lot. And I can't say that about the potential championship winners in soccer leagues in basically any other country. And I think that's something important. This is partly of what MLS is created for, to create parity. And obviously, because humans are humans, parity won't ever totally exist. And so you're going to have some teams be better than others. You're going to have the Cincinnati's of the world that finish dead last three straight years in a row and lose 5-0 in their opening game to Austin.
Poor Cincinnati. Poor Cincinnati. I feel so bad for them.
Oh, my God. Now, you were, as you are, you're based in Miami. You're at the Miami-Chicago game, 0-0. But what stood out to you in that game?
I think the fact that Miami is going to kind of go about this a different way. They kept 40% of the ball at home, but they still created good chances. And I think their idea is, let's start off with being solid, right? You know, Cincinnati can have ambitions to try and step up from where they are. They've got some good young attacking players. They spent a ton of money on Brenner as their center forward, and they want to unleash those guys. But basically, I think the model when you've been bad is start first with not getting beaten by a lot and then build from there. And I think that's what Phil Neville is going to try and implement in Miami. So they played out of a back five. It was not a back three. It was a back five for large stretches of it. First half, they're, you know, just trying to get on. They created a couple of chances. They probably should have opened the scoring with a chance from Leo Campana, their new center forward on loan from Wolves. But he couldn't. He hit the header off the crossbar. So, you know, Miami grew into the game. I think they won the XG battle on the night. And so, you know, Jordan Shaqiri was a threat. And they've got some good attacking pieces. Chicago and Ezra Hendrickson had them playing some decent stuff. But I think Miami is going to try first to establish their foundation and then go from there. And so I think you'll probably see them probably or at least early in the season, probably in some low scoring games, and then they'll try and kick on from there.
No, it's really interesting. I'm curious because I didn't see this game, but what did you think of Gaga Slonina, the 17-year-old? Yeah. Goalkeeper for Chicago? Is he like 17-year-old is crazy, because he looks to me like he's 25.
Yes.
Whenever I see him. What's his deal?
So I think what you said is absolutely right, and it's so impressive for a 17-year-old to almost have like a man's build and a man's command of the penalty area. When you look at the way that he comes out to catch crosses, he does so with authority. when he makes saves, he does so with authority. He made a huge save from an Ari Lassiter strike from about 20 yards out, which he absolutely ripped towards the bottom corner. Salina down to his left, had the strong hand to tip around the post and was hit with real pace. And he just has command of the area. And, you know, Tony Meola, the analyst for Chicago Fire, said, I was at Parma when Gianluigi Buffon was coming through, and he kind of reminds me of him. And wow. That's incredibly lofty praise. I was like looking at you know the tweets about his rumors in the transfer window, and Fabrizio Romano said that they're looking for at least 10 million euros for him, and it could, you know, if he has a really good season, could even be more than that in the summer. And also, Chicago have another young goalkeeper, I think 16 or 17, Chris Brady, who was linked with a move to Club Brugge. So like they all of a sudden have a pipeline of goalkeepers coming through at Chicago. So yeah, Salonina was really impressive, kept a clean sheet, made a couple of really huge saves to keep them in the game.
Very interesting stuff. We'll talk a lot more about MLS in the coming weeks. Lots of games coming. There's 28
teams. Can I very quickly, before you finish up the MLS section, while we were recording this, probably the story of the weekend was LA Galaxy home against NYCFC, the defending champions. Chicharito, 90th minute winner, and absolutely put Maxime Cheneau in just the spin cycle. Ended up on the ground, curled the top corner, spun away in celebration. So I guess the narrative from the weekend is the two stars in LA, Vela and Chicharito, leading their teams to victory. And certainly for the Galaxy, a good start to the season. Although they did start last year pretty well, it really is dependent on Chicharito staying fit. If he does, not only I think are they going to have a good season, but they're, you know, another one of those in the long list of MLS Cup potential winners, because I think he's that good for them, or at least he was that good last season under Greg Vanney when he was fit.
Good stuff. Thanks as always, Chris.
Thanks, Grant.
Now, here's my interview with Kelsey Trainer. Our guest now is Kelsey Trainer. She's a lawyer, producer, writer, and women's sports advocate who is the vice president of business affairs at Gaming Society. She also designed those shirts that say, invest in women, pay women, hire women. You can find her on Twitter at ktrain_11. Kelsey, it's great to see you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
We've got a lot to talk about this week. You're a lawyer. You have followed very closely for years the U.S. women's national team's gender discrimination case against U.S. soccer, which had a huge moment this past week when they announced a $24 million settlement contingent upon getting a CBA done. That deadline for the CBA is March 31st. In your opinion, how historic is this announcement and why?
It's absolutely fantastic. It is historic, right? Like, we're going to look back on this in history, I think, the same way we look back on Billie Jean King and the women of tennis, you know, getting their contracts and playing for a dollar, right? I think it has that same equivalence in the women's sports space. Why? Because you have women who came together and fought for a very, very long time, right? The first filing for this was in 2016. And they used their voices and their positions to effectuate change against a massive organization, a massive governing body. That's hard. I probably could not have done it. And so I think historically the significance is going to be remembered as I think the time that women stopped accepting kind of piecemeal progress and breadcrumbs and really started going after the full meal.
Do you have any concerns that the CBA will get done because this settlement is contingent upon that happening?
My instinct as a lawyer is that they would not, the women, the players of the U.S. Women's National Team and Cindy Parlow Cohn would not have gone on the record, would not have gone on national television to really vouch for this if they did not think that the CBA was going to get done and it was going to be ratified. That would be a huge miss. It's almost like all of this effort and press and everything that was gained by this would be worth absolutely nothing. And so I think there's a very good chance that gets done. And already just by coming up with that figure, right, 24 million, you've regained trust between the U.S. Women's National Team and U.S. Soccer and the Federation. So I absolutely think that there's a good chance that it gets done by the deadline.
Now, another big part of this settlement agreement includes something U.S. Soccer has been saying for a while that it wants now, that it will equalize prize money, including World Cup prize money, between the U.S. women's national team and the U.S. men's national team. Do you think the U.S. men's national team, which is trying to negotiate its own CBA right now, will go along with that?
Again, my instinct is yes. I think if they don't, I think they're putting themselves in the U.S. soccer position of losing in the court of public opinion. From the looks of everything and from kind of whisperings, you know, behind the scenes, it appears that the men are in support of everything that the women have been doing. I know there was times where it felt like they weren't as vocal, but obviously they were negotiating or still negotiating their own CBA. And so I think maybe the writing's on the wall that it, in spite of the fact that men's soccer globally, you know, makes way more money than women's soccer, that the U.S. women's national team has been historically the success of U.S. soccer. And so I think if they don't agree to that, I think there's going to be another massive battle, and I wouldn't want to put myself in that position.
At times during this case, and you alluded to this, the U.S. Men's National Team Players Association, not the individual men's players themselves, has issued statements of support for the women's national team. Did you buy those statements at face value? And a couple of times over the years, even like a few women's players had sort of called out the U.S. men, like saying that none of you specifically came out publicly and supported us. It was just what a lawyer was saying with your players association. So is this, what's your stance on that?
I think I actually wrote an article about it for Equalizer. You know, I think to some extent there was a little bit of posturing there. They were negotiating and still are, right? Like their own CBA, right? And so under the old structure, you know, if the women negotiated a CBA, that would be good for them because then they would go higher than those numbers. It would give the men's national team a really good baseline of what they should be working off of. And so obviously they're going to want to support the women getting paid as much as possible because the history and the standard had been that that's the baseline. And then let's go above and beyond that. So I think there was a bit of posturing, but you know, to the defense of the players individually, right? Like as a lawyer, you're not supposed to speak. You're not supposed to say things. And so I'm sure there was a lot of guidance there from the Players Association and what you, you know, can or can't say publicly. I think there was a bit of posturing. But I'm also not going to, you know, downgrade or deny that I'm sure there's, you know, support there.
Why do you think U.S. soccer settled in the end? I mean, in a court of law, the U.S. women's national team had a judge dismiss their equal pay claims in a summary judgment. They were appealing that ruling, but it was still a defeat. And I'm wondering, is this a situation where the court of public opinion ended up swaying U.S. soccer's actions in the end?
I think there's a few reasons. One, I was very surprised from just a legal perspective that was dismissed by the judge in May of 2020, right? From a comparison under the Equal Pay Act, I was just very surprised that a judge would go to that extent and dismiss the case and wouldn't let it go before a jury. And so I think there was a possible chance that, you know, on appeal, this could be brought back. So, right. So that's one factor. Obviously, we have the U.S. soccer presidential election coming up. I think that was another factor. You had a March 7th deadline for the appeal, a hearing for the appeals. And then you have the March 31st deadline for the CBA. So I think there was a number of things of like why the timing happened. But I think I've said from the beginning that I always saw this settling because the $67 million number that the women sought originally was high. And I don't mean not that they shouldn't have been paid that, but that's just a high number for a lawsuit of this type. And really a high number to get out of kind of any organization in a lawsuit. So I always did think maybe a $20 to $40 million range was the possible scenario. It's a little bit of a shame that so much money was spent on legal fees. I'll say that as a lawyer, it's a real shame that the lawyers got a bunch of money instead of just settling this early on. But I think some attitudes and perspectives kind of had to change for this to happen.
You mentioned the U.S. soccer presidential election. It's March 5th, very soon here. Cindy Parlow Cohn is running for re-election against her predecessor, Carlos Cordero. How much do you think the timing of this settlement announcement had something to do with the timing of the U.S. soccer election? And do you think this helps Cindy Parlow Cohn? Because that's sort of the obvious conclusion. And yet, I don't know, part of me was wondering if like some of these U.S. soccer voters might be unhappy about the amount of money this $24 million is that's going to come out of U.S. soccer.
I think Cindy had said this on the broadcast the other night. I think they worked it out that this was going to potentially be paid over 4 years to the players. So that's one aspect that maybe calmed some fears of some voters. I think that her being in charge and getting this case settled was the knockout punch for the presidential election. I'm not sure. I don't have any insight into this, but I do think if you had the Meg Rapinos and the Alex Morgans, I do think when they saw Carlos running for re-election, you know, that could have potentially been also kind of a fire on their end to continue, because it's not like they weren't already in the process of negotiating, right? But to just continue really harping on that and trying to see if they can get a deal done. Because I mean, you've even seen sponsors come out. I think it was Deloitte that really reiterated that their interest and support of U.S. soccer is going to be contingent on seeing progress. And so, in spite of, you know, maybe other parts of the world going backwards in progress, hopefully that's not something that's going to be happening with U.S. soccer.
I was wondering when this was announced, this settlement, what Hope Solo might say publicly, and she obviously has her own legal case against U.S. soccer that is still alive as far as I know. And then she came out with a very sort of Hope Solo-like strong statement saying she was not celebrating this agreement at all and that the U.S. players could have gotten more and were even selfish about the case, was a word that she used. What do you think was going on there, and what are your thoughts on Solo's statement?
I have a few thoughts. I mean, I don't think I generally agree with her statement as a whole. There are parts of it of that, yes, this is a win, it's a celebration, but it's not the whole meal, right? It is still it's still less than what the players deserve. I think her maybe it's a lack of being able to see a different perspective that she can't see that this fight. That maybe not everybody wants to fight it forever. And so there's many reasons that go into settling a case. It's kind of a cost-benefit analysis and really what is important to you. I don't think everything she said was like wrong in principle when it comes to her total opinion on the equal pay issue. And I think to still kind of feel mad and frustrated about it entirely is understandable. But I obviously, I don't think I agree to the extent of, you know, some of the words she used about some of the players. But again, I was not in those locker rooms. I was not a part of the U.S. Women's National Team during any of that time. So I don't know that my opinion on any of that stuff it matters or is relevant.
Do you have any idea what might happen to Solo's own case now that this other one has been settled?
I believe my last update on it was that everything for Solo's case was stayed. So it was paused pending the resolution of this case, just because they decided not to merge them. But because there was a common interest, like you're not going to waste the court's time by essentially litigating something twice. So that was the last update. I haven't checked the docket to kind of see where it's at now or what the next steps will be. But I think once that gets resolved, you know, obviously the court has to approve the settlement because it's a class action. But once that gets resolved, I think we'll see, you know, Hope's case opening up, and we'll see what happens there. It might have a very similar path or pattern, or it might be completely different. It's in a different district in California than the majority of the U.S. women's national team case, so we'll see.
Megan Rapinoe was very pointed as well, saying the next big step is to go after FIFA and its huge and still growing, by the way, prize money gap between the men's and women's World Cups. What do you think could actually put pressure on FIFA in that area?
There's a deep, deep sigh there, because this to me is like the larger issue of just like the lack of respect and investment that women's sports get compared to men. I do think the pressure has to come from a sponsor perspective, right? Like money talks. There's got to be some discussion and conversation about equity, right? Like, at what point is it enough, right? At what point do we decide that, listen, men's sports historically have had hundreds of years head start than women's sports, okay? And so you're never going to get the ROI. You're never going to get the return on investment if you don't invest, if you don't start evening some things out. So I think it's like a much larger concept and conversation, but realistically, right, it's sponsors who kind of have those values and put that pressure on it, for sure.
I'm curious to get your take on this, because I've noticed another viewpoint from even some, I would call, progressive folks in the soccer world, a lot in Europe, about women's soccer and investment in women's soccer. And so these aren't FIFA people. These are people I would consider to be thoughtful. And like, sometimes what they say is more money should be going to investment in increasing global opportunity for women's soccer, because there are large parts of the world where women don't even play soccer or can't play soccer yet, that money would be better suited going toward that than to more FIFA Women's World Cup prize money. And I'm wondering what you think of that.
Yeah, no, my immediate answer is there's enough money to do all of that, right? Like, there is enough money in soccer generally, globally, to do all of that and then some. So I think it's kind of a red herring argument that you have to pick one or the other, because we don't see that in men's sports. We don't see the, we have to choose, right? No, like, the NBA is going to continue doing everything in the NBA, but they're also creating leagues elsewhere. They're also doing everything else. And so I think it's again, the perspective of who's in charge and what are their values and what are they going to do when they have the power and the money to be able to do all those things.
So U.S. soccer has had several big lawsuits that it has been involved in recent years, and has spent, as you mentioned, millions of dollars in legal fees during that time. Why do you think the Federation has had so many lawsuits?
I mean, quite honestly, I think it's been not like a naming names perspective, but I think it's been who's been in charge, right? Like the almost the old guard and what they think U.S. soccer should be and should represent. And I think the way of doing things has been very old boys club. And, you know, whether purposefully or not, there's been like some kind of built in misogynistic tendencies. And so in the United States, you know, a lot of misogynistic tendencies are illegal. You know, there's laws that come in and say, hey, you can't do that. You can't say that. You can't, you know, pay somebody less for equal work. And so I think when that kind of mentality permeates leadership from top down, right? Like, we can't forget about kind of the youth soccer stratosphere, and the money making that plays into that. But yeah, I think it's been a reckoning that's been needed, and I think we're starting to see a little bit of different perspectives infiltrating U.S. soccer and sports in general, right? Like, just having so many issues of harassment and abuse and so many lawsuits, right? Like, who has the time? The money is so much better spent elsewhere. And so hopefully I think we're starting to see that a little bit.
Now, before we sign off here, I have a couple of questions I want to ask you just about. You've had a very interesting career just from following you on Twitter. What are you doing now in your new job? And what are some of the things you've done in the past?
Yeah, so currently I've just started recently as the VP of Business Affairs at Gaming Society. We're a platform that really educates and makes betting and gaming more accessible. There's a multi-billion dollar market kind of in sports betting and gaming, and obviously betting is like the ultimate form of gamification. And we have a goal to make it more inclusive, make it more accessible, and to bring some of that money into the women's sports space to really, to literally bet on women. And so we have an exclusive license with the WNBPA for that phrase, bet on women. And it's been fun. We're doing some really cool stuff that should be coming up that hopefully, you know, like it's the mentality of like, in order to bet on women, you have to know who they are. And so we're telling the stories, we're getting people involved in gaming and fantasy stuff, right? Like I never cared about any NFL team that was not the Philadelphia Eagles until I started playing fantasy football. And I was watching every game because I needed to make sure that my team was winning that week. So we're really trying to tap into that on the women's sports side of things. And then, yeah, my career has taken many turns. I started out kind of like in corporate insurance. And then I had a friend who was the executive producer of the show Blue Bloods who called me up one day and said, come work for me. And I did. I went from having an assistant to being one. And I worked for him on that show. It's on CBS. And I got a crash course in the entertainment industry. And it was cool because I got to kind of use that platform to continue working with like athletes and actors and people that I knew. You know, helping them from the legal side of things, but always kind of liked PR and branding and all that fun stuff. So I did that for a bit. And then I ended up working in TV and production and media. And so it's all, I feel like I have a full circle space. I also coached college basketball before I went to law school. So I feel like I've tried to merge everything that I really enjoy, you know, sports, entertainment, women's sports. I've tried to figure out a way to like merge all of that into a career that is and then, you know, I'm sure you see it the time or two I spew things out on Twitter and, you know, see what comes back to me.
In my previous life, I was a college basketball writer. In addition to being a soccer writer, I went full-time soccer in 2009 as the sport got bigger and I really got into soccer even more. But one person I had gotten to know pretty well covering college basketball was Jay Billis at ESPN. And he and I even did back and forth columns with each other that we somehow got ESPN and Sports Illustrated to simultaneously publish. And it was a lot of fun. And occasionally there'll be a tweet that you have a connection to Jay Billis. What is that connection?
Yeah. Listen, I'm like Jay Billis's number one fan. He is just such a good human. My connection is that when I was working at my previous job for a media company, I was given a platform to write a column and do a podcast. And I'm sitting there at work and I'm watching TV and I'm like, I see Jay Billis is on ESPN. And I'm talking to my colleague who did this with me. And I was like, man, that'd be really cool if we could get Jay. So I cold emailed him and got a response at a commercial break. And he was like, I'm actually in New York City today. Sure, I'll come up and do your podcast, you know, in like 4 hours. Turns out my boss and him, Danny Abrams was my boss. They both went to Duke. So there was a connection there. But Jay came on the podcast. And then me and colleagues had a chance to kind of grab a drink with him after. And since that day, just no questions asked, he's been such a huge advocate for me. I can shoot him a text and ask him for advice or send him something that I've been working on. He'll share it. So yeah, there's like top five people for me in life. And Jay Billis is one of them. He's a good person. And people forget that he still is a lawyer. Like he still essentially practices. And so I always say like, I kind of wanted to be like the woman version of Jay Billis to, have that insight and explain things from a legal perspective that is not so boring and bogged down.
Kelsey Traynor is a lawyer, producer, writer, and women's sports advocate who's also the vice president of business affairs at Gaming Society. You can find her on Twitter at ktrain_11. Kelsey, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Football with Grant Wall. I'd like to thank Kelsey Traynor, as well as producer and pundit Chris Whittingham. You can now sign up for a free or paid subscription to my newsletter at grantwall.com. The best way to support my work is by taking out a paid subscription. See you next time.